Catherine, and thank you very much for that stirring introduction. It's far more stirring than anything you will hear from me. But I do want to say that although I am only an economist, and by that token, not a very socially useful person, perhaps the least such in this room at the moment, I do have a cousin, a first cousin, a woman by the name of Georgia Sovich, who was for many years a nurse in Burbank, and who therefore holds up the honor of my family. The difficulty I faced in preparing these remarks this morning is that they oblige me to merge two very distinct strands of my work over many years. One of them relates to the measurement and understanding of inequality, but especially economic inequality, and the other one to the great financial crisis that we passed through 5 years ago and the question of what lies beyond. They are related, of course, and so merging them is not an unnatural act. But like the business of mating hedgehogs, it does have to be done with a certain amount of care. The rise in inequality is not something that we've only experienced here. It is a worldwide, a global fact of life. And it is something that conditions and affects us all in practically everything we do, directly and indirectly. I have been studying it for many years, since the issue really came into academic consciousness almost maybe 25, 30 years ago. And I have been using techniques that permit relatively close and timely observation of change, both in this country and around the world. Many other economists have been also looking at various pieces of the puzzle. And those who were focused on the United States and on other relatively wealthy countries often speak of the driving forces of technology on the one side, trade on the other. That is to say, of the role played by new inventions in changing the kind of work that employers demand and the kind of skills that they demand, and of the effect of a wider, more broadly, more generally, common trading areas on the pressure that places on wages. And there is a body of work which also importantly emphasizes the role that unions have played in the past and the weakening of the role that unions have played in the present as a driving force behind the rise in inequality in wage structures. That's one body of work which has been out there for a long time. And then there is a literature which has been assembled by people who are working on the world more broadly and specifically on developing countries, which tends to focus on the posture of public policy, on whether governments in particular are driving for more or less inequality, depending upon their ideologies and the political forces behind them, and also on the relationship between economic inequality and economic growth. Is it good for growth, bad for growth? A very broad set of issues about which, in fact, after a great deal of study, not very much is known. Both of these areas, the rich country literature and the worldwide development literature, have a great deal of dispute still in them, a great many unresolved questions, And for the pretty good reason that the evidence is murky, it's sparse, and it's fairly weak. What I have tried to do in the work that I've undertaken in Texas, mainly with my students, has been to simplify and clarify the story. And we found actually that it's quite possible to do this. What we found is that at the global level, an analysis of turning points and trends show that the driving force behind rising inequality is finance. It's the rise of a debt-ridden, crisis-driven financial regime after the end of the system that was set up to help stabilize the non-communist world at the end of World War II, the so-called Bretton Woods system of exchange rate regimes. The system that came to an end early in the Nixon administration in 1971. And following that change, there was a period worldwide in which inequalities tended to decline, mainly because the poor countries grew rapidly on the strength of high commodity prices. The oil prices that we experienced as a shock were, in many cases, a boon. Other commodity prices, and because parts of the world gained access for the first time to a great flow of commercial debt, of borrowing. And they were able to borrow their way toward prosperity for a short period of time. And then it came to an end. It came to an end in 1980, 1981, with a crashing debt crisis that started in Latin America and Asia and then in Africa and spread around the world, eventually reaching Central Europe, the former Soviet Union, and finally Asia. A relentless worldwide increase in inequality, which showed up very clearly in the data analysis that I and my colleagues have been doing, which peaks in the year 2000. It peaks simultaneously with the peak of the information technology boom in the United States, with the peak of the NASDAQ, and with the worldwide crisis and the crash of interest rates that followed. If you take the story back to the United States, again, you find something very similar. Essentially the same story, but adjusted for the fact that we are the center of global finance, not just a recipient of it. The American story is driven by finance. If you measure income inequality in this country, frankly, it tracks the stock market very closely. And there's no surprise in that. Corporate stocks are held by a very small number of people. When they go up in price, so do the incomes of that very small number of people relative to everybody else. This is, as I say, a simple and clear story which shows up very well if one does a lot of work with the numbers. And those gains, which are gains at the top in this country, are highly localized. And I say, this is surely no surprise here in California, but the major centers of gain are New York, specifically New York County in New York State, which is Manhattan. In Silicon Valley in Northern California in the 1990s, King County in Washington State. And if you move a little bit forward in time and look at the what we'll call the war years, Afghanistan and Iraq in the early 2000s, the big gains are right around the capital area in the beltway around Washington, D.C. That's where incomes grow more rapidly than any place else in the country. And if you move it a little bit further forward, still up to the period just before the Great Crisis, you find that outside of the banking centers, which are always major income gainers in times of a credit boom, than the gangs are there around here in Southern California. They are in Florida in various places and in other parts of the country where you had construction booms that were driven by speculative credit just before the crash. How important are these areas? Well, we did a little experiment. We took the question of what would happen if we simply subtracted five counties out of the data. Now, the United States has 3,150 counties, but if you take five of them away between 1990 and 2000, and the five are New York, Santa Clara, San Mateo, and San Francisco, King County, Washington, about half of the increase in inequality measured between counties actually goes away. That gives you an idea of how concentrated the rise in incomes actually was and what its nature was. Stock options, realizations, capital gains. Here's an interesting and I think striking fact that emerges from just a bit of reflection about what I have just said. The experience of rising income inequality in a country like ours isn't necessarily disagreeable. If you think back to the late 1990s, those were good times. Unemployment rate fell below 4% for three or four consecutive years. Wages rose. The working population, I'm sure many people have experience of having multiple jobs in their households and multiple streams of income. Okay? It's not necessarily a bad thing while it lasts. And that is the rub. That is truly the difficulty with having an economy that's organized on the basis of prosperity driven by credit booms, driven by extraordinary flows of income, controlled by a tiny number of very rich people. I have an analogy for you, which I did not invent simply because you're an audience of healthcare workers. But perhaps this may resonate with you. It seems to me that when you think about economic inequality, as I observe it, measure it in the data, it's rather like blood pressure. Right? That is to say, there's a range which we would consider to be reasonably healthy. And when you're in that range, lower is better on the whole. Now, it's possible for it to be too low, right? The measure of zero for inequality as well as for blood pressure is something which you're going to find only in the morgue. Okay? But the crucial point is that when you think about this, and it's not too complex a metaphor, is what happens when the number starts to rise? Well, it's a danger sign. It may, in fact, be asymptomatic, at least for a while, or the symptoms may be observable but easy to ignore. But it's a sign that you may be heading for a crisis. And of course, the crisis came. We lived for 20 years, 1980 to 2000. In the United States and in the world, in an economy driven by higher and higher levels of inequality. And if my argument is correct, the crisis really hit us in 2000, and we've been living with it ever since, and I want to talk about that briefly. And it came not in 2007, but actually in 2000 with the collapse of the NASDAQ and the end of the information technology boom. And I would suggest that we may look back on this in history and say that was the last big business boom that we're going to see. The last boom driven by a genuine enthusiasm for new wave of profits and business activity. And when it ended, well, we weren't quite prepared to accept the fact that it had ended. And we got a president, the ineffable governor of my adopted home state, George W. Bush, who was determined to use every trick in the book to persuade people that it could go on. I used to say in Texas that I was a great follower of George W. Bush. You gave an overly long, revealing list of my educational credentials, but I would give political speeches in Texas and say, you know, I followed him. I followed him to Andover. I followed him to Harvard. I followed him to Yale. I followed him to Texas, and then I stopped following him. But you can't say the guy didn't try. He pulled out one rabbit out of the hat, which was tax cuts. And he pulled another rabbit out of the hat, which was the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. I don't say that he did that to boost the economy, but it had that effect for a short period of time. And in 2004, he actually told the Congress, send up any appropriations bill you want, I'll sign it. So he was a fiscal Keynesian for a while. And the biggest rabbit he pulled out of his hat was the financialization of the real estate market and the globalization of a financialized real estate market. The signal sent that a market which was already deregulated largely by the time he took office, and that was Clinton's doing, was also going to be desupervised. That they were not going to look at the underwriting standards for the mortgage originators. That they were not going to be observing what the banks were doing and the investment banks were doing when they bundled those loans and sold them off to unsuspecting Germans. There's a great moment in Michael Lewis's book, The Big Short, where one banker says to another, who's buying this stuff anyway? And the answer comes back, Dusseldorf. And all of this served a purpose, which was that it continued the illusion and to some degree the reality of continued economic growth. A reality founded on making loans to people who it was known would never be able to repay, who would have to refinance or default down the road, 2 years' time, 3 years' time, when their mortgages reset. It was growth based on fraud, financial fraud, the greatest wave of it ever seen in human history, and in a country which is not without experience of financial fraud. I mean, it wasn't the first time we've seen this. This is just the largest manifestation of it we've ever seen. Point I want to make is that in the context of this moment, this was not an aberration. This was, if you put the whole thing together, clearly a policy. A policy which helped obscure the fact that we were in a different world than we had been in before 2000. And if that's true, then the crisis of 2007 to 2009 was not simply what economists quickly adopted the habit of calling it, namely a great recession, a downturn, a business cycle event, perhaps an unusually deep and severe one, but still an ordinary extension of experience that we'd all had since the 1940s. It was instead, I would argue, the final failure of efforts to mask a great historical turning point, which was the end of this era of credit-fueled economic expansions, based even slightly on genuine optimism and honest accounting. an era which had come to an end, as I say, in 2000. To speak of another health care issue which has been prominently in the news in the last few days, we have seen a rise in suicides in this country. And that rise has been particularly sharp since these events in 2007, 2008. But if you read the stories, and I'm sure many of you have, it's noted by the CDC that the rise actually began considerably earlier. It began in 2000. Right? And that's not a surprise. If you think about these things as being largely driven by people's understanding of their real economic prospects, it surely dawned on a great many people that the world had changed long before the politicians admitted it would change and long before the economists would admit that it would change. The economists' habit, the habit of my profession, in a slump, is to make an artificial projection of what things would be like if the slump had never occurred. This is called potential output. It's a projection from the previous peak. And then we call full employment something which is close to the experience seen in the last time when things were really prosperous. And then we project a model, we invent a model, which gets us back to those values, potential output and full employment, over a reasonable period of time. 5 years is kind of the normal practice in the profession, a normal period of recovery. Notice the medical metaphor, by the way, in all of this. Long-term problems are those which will exist after the recovery has been achieved. That the recovery will be achieved is not in doubt. The economist, in other words, is a doctor with one patient who has never failed to rebound from minor sicknesses. And this is a doctor who doesn't have any experience of any patients who don't actually make it out and come back. This is a doctor with experience rather more limited than that of any actual doctor in any actual real world. Right? That's the economist for you. And then the return to normal doesn't occur. And when it doesn't, we, the doctors who have no experience of a chronic condition, are torn between a number of equally dubious reactions. The first, which is the reaction of the Congressional Budget Office, to name a specific culpable party, is simply to roll the forecast forward. Well, the recovery didn't start this year, it will start next year. The European Commission in Europe does exactly the same thing. I was reading the economic forecasts for Greece and Spain and Portugal that they issued yesterday. Oh, things are terrible, they're getting worse, but in 6 months' time, they'll start getting better. Right? The Greeks have been reading this for 5 years. They must be getting a bit tired of it. Right? And that's also true in the United States, with the Congressional Budget Office, which has been rolling its forecast now for 5 years. A second way of looking at this is to say, well, the recovery would have occurred, but something must be getting in the way. This is the Tea Party approach, by the way. That something is the government. If the government were not there providing people with unemployment insurance, they would be working. Makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? I assure you that if the man from Mars arrived to an intensive care unit with his economic statistician as a sidekick, they would walk in and they would notice that a great many patients are tied to IV bottles. And they would say, my gosh, we don't see the IV bottles on people who are walking around in the street. So it must be the case that those fluids are causing people to be sick. Let's just get rid of the intravenous, and everybody will be well, right? As I said. that's the Tea Party crowd, that's the austerity crowd, that's Erskine Bowles, that's Pete Peterson, that's Alan Simpson. That's all these people who say the problem is the budget deficit. The budget deficit is in fact the IV fluid, which provides people with incomes when the private sector isn't functioning properly. You cut it back, it is not going to make the patient better. If you don't believe me, ask a Greek. And the third, and here I tread a little closer to my own ideological territory and on the toes of my friends, but the third approach is to say, well, we just didn't do enough. Right? This is the stimulus approach, that we need more, which perhaps is true up to a point, but I think it is pushing it too far to say that there would have been full recovery had we done more. Because I think to say that is to convey, again, the false impression that the previous peak is there to be achieved in the current situation. That's my, Paul Krugman is an ally of mine on many issues, but we differ on this one. I don't think that there is a straightforward path to ending the depression by the means that were used in the 1930s or the 1940s. And I think that's because we live in a different world now, and we have to think clearly and freshly about the conditions that we face. In other words, we need a fourth way, a practical path, which is not necessarily a path back to some previous growth track which was artificial and unsustainable in the first place. And here are the reasons why I think this is the case. The reasons I think you're all familiar with, as they affect all of our daily lives. The first is that we are a resource-driven economy, like all economies, and we are a resource-using economy, so we are affected by the cost of resources. And the cost of resources has risen. It was already rising 40 years ago when we stopped having unlimited quantities, essentially, of cheap oil from Texas and had to start buying it from the Middle East, from the Persian Gulf. But we masked that change over 20 or 30 years, and now, for the last decade, we have discovered we can mask it no longer. And we're going to have to think very hard about what to do in a world where the cost of the energy we use is much higher. And this is a drain directly on the profits of private business. It may be, many people believe this problem will go away because of natural gas and hydrofracking. Okay, that's out of my area of expertise. I just have to say, I've heard this song before, and I think we should be approached with skepticism. And even if it's true, it would be not wise to believe we can run off again to another half century of high growth fueled by cheap energy, because we have an understanding of climate change that we didn't have before. A closely related fact, for those of you who may be militarists, there are probably not a whole lot of you in this audience, is that we've clearly learned in the last decade that we cannot control the rest of the world. That's the message of Iraq, of Afghanistan. A message which should be stated by all of us who understand it, because there are a few people around who still haven't gotten it. I believe, though, that our professional soldiers understand it very well. And it's something which we who are not soldiers, who can speak freely, should be saying for the benefit of all of us, but especially for the benefit of people who shouldn't be in the position of being given impossible missions. Coming back closer to home, there's a third issue, which is the role being played in all of our lives by technology. I have previously rejected the idea that technology is the driving force behind inequality, but I do think it has a lot to do with jobs. and particularly in the environment after the crisis. Businesses, when they're faced with a crunch, they lay off workers. When things pick up, they may look around to see what's available by way of new technologies that can forestall bringing all those workers back. And in our current technological wave, there's a lot of that. The digital technologies are massively labor-saving. One could say that they are doing to the office worker and many other types of workers what the internal combustion engine did a century ago to the horse. But that leaves us with a substantially more important problem than, well, the horses had a pretty serious problem, but let's just say the horses weren't organized. I sometimes get pushback on this, particularly from economists and students who are very optimistic, who say, well, we've always created jobs in the wake of past technological upheavals. But last night I went to the restaurant across here from the pool, and I noticed that my order was being taken by a machine. I said, you know, I better leave this in the speech because there's evidence of it all around us. And then we have burdens on the economy that we need to think about. Big institutions that charge a lot of freight. The modern equivalent, if you like, of the 19th century railroad monopolists. Right? They're out there. What are they? They're the banks. This is not a mystery. We have moved into a world quite recently where we have a half a dozen banks with 60% of the market. These are very big, very expensive organizations which believe, with some reason, that the public will continue to support them in the manner to which they have become accustomed. In return for what? Payment services that could be provided by a utility? It's a good question. We have banks for a public purpose, which is to say to give us a decentralized decision-making mechanism as to who gets credit, so that decision is not taken by government bureaucrats all the time. I think that's a good thing. I don't know the distinction, though, between having one government bureaucracy and six big banks in terms of the independence, the decentralization, the democratic accountability, the supervisability of what's going on. And it's pretty obvious to me that the banks, wanting to preserve their share, are behind the cutting back of healthcare and other services that we see constant pressure for, because this is a competition for free resources in the society, and we have to decide which do we value more. Actual healthcare services or functionless financiers? It's a difficult proposition, people. I ask you to reflect on it. What can the government do in this situation? I think the government is able to stabilize things. And we've seen that. We have the mechanisms. Actually, in great advantage of the United States over Europe is that we did, in fact, stabilize incomes after the crisis. Output and employment went down by about 8-10%. Incomes only dropped by a few percentage points. Terrific accomplishment. We're able to preserve institutions. That's what the Federal Reserve did for the banking system. Are we able to put ourselves on a track back to 4-5% unemployment and high levels of output? No, it's clear that we're not. Energy is a choke chain, technology is a drag, finance is a headwind. So let me conclude by just asking, what should we do? One can, of course, go back to the New Deal and rattle off grand projects, but that only raises a question that a book reviewer once directed at a youthful effort of mine. It said, you and whose army? So I think that's not the appropriate approach. I think the right way to do things is to proceed based upon the most urgent needs that we have and that we can in fact meet with institutions and mechanisms that we already know. We could provide relief to homeowners, keep people in their homes, reduce principals on their mortgages, allow people to cram them down in bankruptcy, give them a right to rent if they're foreclosed, stabilize neighborhoods. That's something we could do, we should do, we haven't done. We could raise the minimum wage a lot. My target is $12 an hour. When I spoke at the AFL-CIO a few weeks ago, Rich Trumka quickly raised me to 15. I said, I know, I'm in a union hall. We could provide earlier retirement on better terms for a while to my generation. Not cut back Social Security, which works, but expand it. And just give people who are in my age bracket, but who have real jobs, who stand up on the job all day. I mean, people like me, it doesn't matter, but there are people who actually work for a living. Right? Give them a chance to leave the labor force if that's what they want to do. Right? On decent terms. We can afford this. Right? The notion that people should be retiring later when there are no jobs for the people coming into the labor force who want to form families and households and so forth is preposterous. Right? Push back on that. We should support our states and localities who provide public services like teaching and public safety and parks and libraries. That's why I pushed for revenue sharing early on in this. Just stabilize things. Don't allow essential public services to be sacrificed to the general climate of stability. Of course we have to take over, downsize, and restructure the big banks. You can't have everything, folks. So I just ask you to sacrifice in a few small areas, and that's one of them. I'm sorry if you own bank shares in large quantities, but can't have everything. And then let's come back to the issues affecting, close on the issues affecting the largest single sector in the American economy, which is healthcare. Right? We should be working toward, as you are working toward, a system of stronger, more comprehensive, affordable health insurance, reducing, providing services effectively, but also reducing the financial risk associated with getting sick. Okay? This is the way toward a healthier society because the economics of it and the health aspects of it are not separable. Poverty caused by ill health is obviously a great source of further ill health. We can deal with this. Would these measures, let's call it a strategy based upon solidarity, mutual support, collective insurance, a program of economic self-defense based upon a vision of mutual caring, would that be something new under the sun? I think not. I think if you look back at the history of the New Deal, of Social Security and the minimum wage and the Wagner Act, that's exactly what the core of the New Deal was. Yes, there were other things, great construction projects and so forth, but the core of it was building a common community in an era of economic depression that provided the country with a reason to stay together as a civilization. And the Great Society, Medicare, Medicaid, extended the New Deal's accomplishments into the domain of healthcare. So building upon the basic structures of, let's say, the formation of a strong American common social framework. Would these measures by themselves give us back full employment, prosperity, high rates of economic growth? No. But they would achieve what is possible. Stability, maybe a modest positive growth rate, leaving some space for private businesses to grow and flourish. And if we could do that much in comparison to what we see going around the world, that would be a huge accomplishment and a model for much of the rest of the world's population. So that's what I suggest. Taking account of the difficulties that we're in an honest way, building upon the institutions that we already have, and engaging the talents and the energies of people like yourselves to really do the hard work, because it's going to be up to you in the end. Thanks very much.